Side 2, Cradle, by Arthur C. Clarke and Gentry Lee. Continuing on page 31. Cut the crap, Jefferson, Nick reacted. This woman is a potential customer, and you're late as usual. How do you expect me to run a charter dive boat when I don't have any idea when or if my crew is going to show up? Professor, the newcomer jumped down on the boat and walked up to Carol. If I had known that you had something that looked like this down here, I would have been here before dawn. Hello there, young lady. My name is Troy Jefferson. I am the rest of the crew on this lunatic asylum off a boat. Carol had been slightly discombobulated by the arrival of Troy and the quick repartee that followed. But she adapted swiftly and regained her composure. She took Troy's outstretched hand and smiled. He immediately leaned up and almost brushed his cheek against hers. Ooh-wee, Troy pulled back, grinning. I just caught a whiff of Oscar de la Renta. Professor, didn't I tell you this woman had class? Well, Angel, he looked at Carol in mock admiration, I just can't tell you how much it means to me to finally meet up with someone like you on this tub. Usually we get old ladies. I mean old ladies who want to... Enough, Jefferson, Nick interrupted him. We have work to do. It's almost noon already, and we're still at least half an hour away from being ready to leave. We don't even know what Miss Dawson wants to do.
Carol is fine, she said. She paused for a moment, assessing the two men in front of her.
Might as well, Carol thought. Nobody is going to suspect anything if I'm with these two.
Well, I told the desk that I wanted to go out to do some swimming and diving. But that's only partially true. What I really want to do is go out here. She pulled a folded map out of her beach bag and showed them an area of about 10 square miles in the Gulf of Mexico to the north of Key West, and look for whales.
Nick's brow furrowed. Troy peered over Carol's shoulder at the map.
There have been numerous irregularities in the behavior of whales in this area lately, including a major beaching at Deer Key this morning, Carol continued. I want to see if I can find any pattern in their actions. I may need to do some diving, so one of you will have to accompany me. I assume that at least one of you is a licensed diver and that your dive gear is on board.
The two men regarded her with disbelieving stares. Carol felt on the defensive.
Really? I'm a reporter, she said as an explanation. I work for the Miami Herald. I just did a story this morning on the Deer Key beaching.
Troy turned to Nick. Okay, Professor, I guess we have a live charter here. One who says she wants to look for whales in the Gulf of Mexico. What do you say? Should we accept her money? Nick shrugged his shoulders indifferently, and Troy took it as assent. All right, Angel, Troy said to Carol. We'll be ready in half an hour. We're both licensed divers, if we're really needed. Our gear is on board, and we can get more for you. Why don't you pay Julianne at the desk and get your things together? Troy turned and walked over to the jumbled mess of electronics at the front of the boat. He picked up one of the boxes with its housing partially removed and began toying with it. Nick pulled another beer out of the refrigerator and opened the built-in counters, exposing racks of equipment. Carol did not move. After about 20 seconds, Nick noticed that she was still there.
Well, he said in a tone of dismissal, didn't you hear, Troy? We won't be ready for half an hour.
He turned around and walked toward the back of the boat. Troy looked up from his repair work. He was amused by the friction already developing between Nick and Carol.
Is he always so pleasant?
Carol said to Troy, nodding in Nick's direction. She was still smiling, but her tone conveyed some irritation.
I have a few pieces of equipment that I want to bring on board. Can you give me a hand with it?
30 minutes later, Troy and Carol returned to the Florida Queen. Troy was grinning and whistling zippity-doo-dah as he pulled a cart down the jetty and came to a stop in front of the boat. A partially filled footlocker was resting on the cart. Troy could hardly wait to see Nick's face when he saw Carol's few pieces of equipment. Troy was excited by the turn of events. He knew that this was no casual afternoon charter. Reporters, even successful ones, and Troy's street intelligence had quickly informed him that Carol was not just an ordinary reporter, did not have everyday access to the kind of equipment that she was carrying. Already, Troy was certain that the whale story was just a cover, but he wasn't going to say anything just yet. He wanted to wait and see how things developed. Troy liked this confident young woman. There was not a trace of superiority or prejudice in her manner, and she had a good sense of humor. After they had opened the back of her station wagon and she had showed him the footlocker full of equipment, Troy had demonstrated to Carol that he was fairly sophisticated about electronics. He had recognized immediately the MOI insignia on Dale's ocean telescope, and Troy had even guessed the meaning of the MOI-IPL acronym on the back of the large monitor and data storage system. When he had looked at her for an explanation, Carol had just laughed and said, "So I need some help finding the whales. What can I say?" Carol and Troy had loaded the gear on a cart and wheeled it through the parking lot. She had been a little dismayed at first by Troy's recognition of the origin of the equipment and his friendly probing questions, which she handled adroitly with vague answers. She was helped by the fact that Troy wanted mostly to know how the electronics worked, and she, in truth, didn't have the foggiest idea. But as they talked, Carol developed a comfortable feeling about Troy. Her intuitive sense told her that Troy was an ally and could be counted on to be discreet with any important information. Carol had not, however, planned for a security check inside the Hemingway Marina headquarters. One of the primary selling points of the slips at the new marina had been the almost unparalleled security system offered the boat owners. Every person who went in or out of the marina had to pass through computerized gates adjacent to the headquarters building. A full listing of each individual entrance and exit, including the time of passage through the gate, was printed out each night and retained in the security office files as a precaution in case any suspicious or untoward events were reported. Materiel entering and leaving the marina was also routinely scrutinized and logged by the security chief to prevent the theft of expensive navigation equipment and other electronics. Carol was only mildly irked when, after she paid for the charter, Julianne asked her to fill out a sheet describing the contents of the closed footlocker. But Carol really objected when the summoned security chief, a typical Boston Irish policeman who had retired in the Key West area, forced her to open the locker to verify the contents. Carol's objections and Troy's attempts to help her were to no avail. Rules were rules. Because the cart would not fit through the door into the adjacent security office, the footlocker was opened in the main clearing room of the marina headquarters. A couple of curious passers-by, including one giant, friendly woman about 40 named Ellen, Troy knew her from somewhere, probably she was one of the boat owners, Carol thought, came over and watched while Officer O'Rourke carefully compared the contents of the locker with the list that Carol had prepared. Carol was a little rattled as she and Troy pulled the cart down the jetty toward the Florida Queen. She had hoped to attract as little attention as possible, and she was now angry with herself for not anticipating the security check. Nick, meanwhile, after performing a few routine preparations on the boat and opening another beer, had become engrossed again in the basketball game. His beloved Harvard was now losing to Tennessee. He did not even hear Troy's whistling until his crewman and Carol were just a few yards away. "Jesus," Nick turned around. "I thought you had gotten lost." His voice trailed off as he saw the cart and the footlocker. "What the fuck is that?" "It's Miss Dawson's equipment, Professor," Troy answered with a big grin. He reached into the locker, first picking up a cylinder with a clear glass face, a large flashlight-looking object on a mounting bracket. It was about 2 feet long and weighed about 12 pounds. "Here, for example, is what she tells me is an ocean telescope. We attach it to the bottom of the boat by this bracket, and it takes pictures that are displayed on this here television monitor and also stored on this other device, a recorder of some..." "Hold it," Nick interrupted Troy imperiously. Nick walked up the gangplank and stared incredulously into the locker. He shook his head and looked from Troy to Carol. "Do I have this right? We are supposed to set up all this shit just to go out into the Gulf for one afternoon to look for whales?" He scowled at Troy. "Where is your head, Jefferson? This stuff is heavy. It will take time to set it up, and it's already afternoon." "And as for you, sister," Nick continued, turning to Carol, "take your toys and your treasure map elsewhere. We know what you're up to, and we have more important things to do."
"Are you through?"
Carol shouted at Nick as he walked back down the gangplank onto the Florida Queen. He stopped and turned partially around.
Look, you asshole, Carol raged, giving vent to the frustration and anger that had been building inside of her. It is certainly your right to deny me the use of your boat, but it is not your right to act like God Almighty and treat me or anyone else like shit just because I'm a woman and you feel like pushing somebody around. She stepped toward him. Nick backed up a step in the face of her continued offensive. I told you that I want to look for whales, and that's what I intend to do. What you might think I'm doing is really of no significance to me. As for the important things that you have to do, you haven't moved from that goddamn basketball game in the last hour except to get more beer. If you'll just stay out of the way, Troy and I can set all this gear in place in half an hour. And besides, Carol slowed down just a bit, starting to feel a little embarrassed about her outburst. I have already paid for the charter, and you know how hard it is to straighten out these computer credit card accounts.
Ooh-wee, Professor. Troy grinned wickedly and winked at Carol. Isn't she something else?
He stopped and became serious.
Look, Nick, we need the money, both of us. And I would be happy to help her. We can take off some of the excess diving gear if it's necessary to balance the weight.
Nick walked back to the folding chair and the television. He took another drink from his beer and did not turn around to look at Carol and Troy.
All right, he said, somewhat reluctantly. Get started. But if we're not ready to sail by 1 o'clock, it's no deal.
The basketball players swam in front of his eyes. Harvard had tied the game again. But this time he wasn't watching. He was thinking about Carol's outburst. I wonder if she's right. I wonder if I do think that women are inferior. Or worse.
5. Commander Vernon Winters was trembling when he hung up the phone. He felt as if he had just seen a ghost. He threw his apple core in the waste basket and reached in his pocket for one of his pell-mells. Without thinking, he stood up and walked across the room to the large bay window that opened onto the grassy courtyard of the main administration building. Lunch hour had just finished at the U.S. Naval Air Station. The crowds of young men and women heading either toward or away from the cafeteria had died out. A solitary young ensign was sitting on the grass reading a book, his back against a large tree. Commander Winters lit his non-filter cigarette and inhaled deeply. He expelled the smoke with a rush and quickly took another breath.
Hey, Indiana, the voice had said 2 minutes before. This is Randy. Remember me?
As if he could ever forget that nasal baritone. And then, without waiting for an answer, the voice had materialized into an earnest face on the video monitor. Admiral Randolph Hilliard was sitting behind his desk in a large Pentagon office.
Good, he continued. Now we can see each other.
Hilliard had paused for a moment and then leaned forward toward the camera.
I was glad to hear that Duckett put you in charge of this Panther business. It could be nasty. We must find out what happened, quickly and with no publicity. Both the Secretary and I are counting on you.
What had he said in response to the Admiral? Commander Winters couldn't remember, but he assumed that it must have been all right. And he did remember the last few words when Admiral Hilliard had said that he would call back for an update after the meeting on Friday afternoon. Winters had not heard that voice for almost 8 years, but the recognition was instantaneous. And the memories that flooded forth were just a few milliseconds behind. The commander took another drag from his cigarette and turned away from the window. He walked slowly across the room. His eyes slid across, but did not see the lovely soft print of the Renoir painting, De Jeune Fille au Piano. That was the most prominent object on his office wall. It was his favorite painting. His wife and son had given him the special large reproduction for his 40th birthday. Usually several times a week he would stand in front of it and admire the beautiful composition. But two graceful young girls working on their afternoon piano lessons were not the order for the day. Vernon Winters sat back down at his desk and buried his face in his hands. Here it comes again, he thought. I can't hold it back now, not after seeing Randy and hearing that voice. He looked around and then stubbed out the cigarette in the large ashtray on his desk. For a few moments, he played aimlessly with the two small framed photographs on his desk. One was a portrait of a pale 12-year-old boy together with a plain woman in her early 40s. The other was a cast photo from the Key West Players production of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, dated March 1993, in which Winters was dressed in a summer business suit. At length, the commander put the photographs aside, leaned back in his chair, closed his eyes, and succumbed to the powerful pull of his memory. A curtain in his mind parted, and he was transported to a clear, warm night almost 8 years before, in early April of 1986. The first sound that he heard was the excited nasal voice of Lieutenant Randolph Hilliard. "Psst! Indiana, wake up! How can you be asleep?" "It's Randy. We've got to talk. I'm so excited I could shit." Vernon Winters had only fallen asleep himself about an hour before. He unconsciously looked at his watch. Almost 2 o'clock. His friend stood next to his bunk, grinning from ear to ear. "Only 3 more hours and we attack. Finally, we're going to blast that Arab lunatic and terrorist supporter into heaven with Allah." "Shit, big buddy. This is our moment. This is what we worked our whole life for." Winter shook his head and began to come out of a deep sleep. It took him a moment to remember that he was on board the USS Nimitz off the coast of Libya. The first action of his military career was about to occur. "Look, Randy," Winters had said eventually, on that night almost 8 years ago, "shouldn't we be sleeping? What if the Libyans attack us tomorrow? We'll have to be alert." "Shit, no," said his friend and fellow officer, helping him to sit up and handing him a cigarette. "Those geeks will never attack someone who can fight. They're terrorists. They only know how to fight unarmed people. The only one of them that has any guts is that Colonel Gaddafi, and he's nutty as a fruitcake. After we blow him to kingdom come, the battle will be over. Besides, I have enough adrenaline flowing that I could stay awake for 36 hours with no sweat." Winters felt the nicotine coursing through his body. It reawakened the eager anticipation that he had finally conquered when he had fallen asleep an hour earlier. Randy was talking a blue streak. "I can't believe how goddamn lucky we are. For 6 years I have been wondering how an officer can stand out, distinguish himself, you know, in peacetime. Now here we are. Some loony plants a bomb in a club in Berlin, and we just happen to be on duty in the med. Talk about being in the right place at the right time. Shit. Think how many other midshipmen from our class would give their right not to be here instead of us. Tomorrow we kill that crazy man, and we're on our way to captain, maybe even admiral, in 5 to 8 years. Winters reacted negatively to his friend's suggestion that one of the benefits of the strike against Gaddafi would be an acceleration in their personal advancement, but he said nothing. He was already deep in his own private thoughts. He too was excited, and he didn't fully understand why. The excitement was similar to the way he had felt before the state quarterfinals in basketball in high school. But Lieutenant Winters couldn't help wondering how much the excitement would be leavened by fear if they were preparing to engage in a real battle. For almost a week, they had been getting ready for the strike. It was normal Navy business to go through the preparations for combat and then have them called off, usually about a day ahead of the planned encounter. But this time, it had been different from the beginning. Hilliard and Winters had quickly recognized that there was a seriousness in the senior officers that had never been there before. None of the usual horsing around and nonsense had been tolerated in the tedious and boring checks of the planes, the missiles, and the guns. The Nimitz was preparing for war. And then yesterday, the normal time for such a drill to be called off, the captain had gathered all the officers together and told them that he had received the order to attack at dawn. Winter's heart had skipped a beat as the commanding officer had briefed them on the full scope of the American action against Libya. Winter's last assignment, just after evening mess, had been to go over the bombing targets with the pilots one more time. 2 separate planes were being sent to bomb the residence where Gaddafi was supposedly sleeping. One of the 2 chosen pilots was outwardly ecstatic. He realized that he had been given the prime target of the raid. The other pilot, Lieutenant Gibson from Oregon, was quiet but thorough in his preparations. He kept looking at the map with Winters and going over the Libyan gun emplacements. Gibson also complained that his mouth was dry and drank several glasses of water.
Shit, Indiana. You know what's bothering me? Those fly boys will be in the battle, and we'll be stuck here with no role unless the crazy Arabs decide to attack. How can we get into the fight? Wait, I just had a thought. Lieutenant Hilliard was still talking nonstop. It was after 3 o'clock, and they had already gone over everything associated with the attack at least twice. Winters was feeling lifeless and enervated from lack of sleep, but the astonishing Hilliard continued to exude exuberance. What a great idea, Randy continued, talking to himself. But we can do it. You briefed the pilots tonight, didn't you? So you know who's going after what targets? Vernon nodded his head. Then that's it. We'll tape a personal screw you to the side of the missile that's going to get Gaddafi. That way, part of us will go into battle. Vernon did not have the energy to dissuade Randy from his crazy plan. As the time for the attack drew closer, Lieutenants Winters and Hilliard went into the hangar on the Nimitz and found the airplane assigned to Lieutenant Gibson. Winters never knew why, but he immediately assumed it would be Gibson who would score a missile on the Gaddafi enclave. Laughingly, Randy explained to the fresh ensign on watch what he and Vernon were going to try to do. It took them almost half an hour to locate the right plane and then identify the missile that would be the first to be launched against the Gaddafi household. The two lieutenants argued for almost 10 minutes about the message they were going to write on the paper that would be taped on the missile. Winters wanted something deep, almost philosophical, like, "Such is the just end to the tyranny of terrorism." Hilliard argued persuasively that Winters' concept was too obscure. At length, the tired Lieutenant Winters assented to the visceral communication written by his friend. "Die, motherfucker," was the message the two lieutenants inscribed on the side of the missile. Winters returned to his bunk exhausted. Tired and still a little unsettled by the magnitude of the coming day's events, he pulled out his personal Bible to read a few verses. There was no comfort in the good book for the Presbyterian from Indiana. He tried praying generic prayers at first, and then more specific, as had been his custom during critical moments in his life. He asked for the Lord to guard his wife and son, and to be with him in this moment of travail. And then, quickly and without thinking, Lieutenant Vernon Winters asked God to rain down terror in the form of the missile with the taped message on Colonel Gaddafi and all his family. 8 years later, sitting in his office at the U.S. Naval Air Station in Key West, Commander Winters would remember that prayer and cringe inside. Even then, in 1986, just after he finished the prayer, he had felt weird and disoriented, almost as if he had somehow committed a blasphemy and displeased the Lord. A brief hour of sleep that followed was torturous, full of dreams of hideous gargoyles and vampires. He watched the planes leave the carrier the next morning at dawn in a dreamlike trance. His mouth had a bitter metal taste when he mechanically shook Gibson's hand and wished him luck. For all those years, Winters had wished that he could have rescinded that prayer. He was convinced that God had permitted that particular missile carried by Gibson to take the life of Gaddafi's infant daughter just to teach Winters a personal lesson. On that day, he thought as he sat in his office on a Thursday in March 1994, "I committed sacrilege and violated your trust. I overstepped my bound and lost my privileged position in your sanctuary. I have asked for forgiveness many times since then, but it has not been forthcoming. How much longer must I wait?" 6. Vernon Allen Winters was born on June 25, 1950, the day that the North Koreans invaded South Korea. He was reminded of the significance of his birth date throughout his life by his father, Martin Winters, a man who was a hard-working, deeply religious corn farmer in Indiana at the time Vernon was born. When Vernon was 3 years old and his sister Linda was 6, the family moved off the farm and into the town of Columbus, a white, middle-class town of 30,000 or so in south-central Indiana. Vernon's mother had felt isolated out on the farm, particularly during the winter, and wanted more company. The Winters' farm provided a nice cash profit. Mr. Winters, by now almost 40, put most of the nest egg aside as security for a rainy day and became a banker. Martin Winters was proud to be an American.
Whenever Mr. Winters would tell Vernon about the day of his birth, the story would inevitably center around the news of the start of the Korean War and how it was explained to the nation by President Harry Truman. "I thought that day," Mr. Winters would say, "that it was surely no coincidence. The good Lord brought you to us that special day because of His purpose for you. And I bet He meant for you to be a protector of this wonderful country we have created." Later, Banker Winters would always see to it that the Army-Navy football game was one of the key events of the year, and he would tell his friends, particularly when it became obvious that young Vernon was a good student, that the boy is still trying to choose which of the academies to attend. Vernon was never asked. The Winters family lived a simple Midwestern life. Mr. Winters was moderately successful, eventually becoming the senior vice president of the largest bank in Columbus. The family's chief social activity was church. They were Presbyterians and spent almost all day Sunday at the church. Mrs. Winters ran the Sunday school. Mr. Winters was a deacon and voluntarily managed the church finances. Vernon and Linda helped supervise the smaller children at Sunday school and were responsible for the special Bible displays on the bulletin boards in the kindergarten and primary school rooms. During the week, Mrs. Winters sewed and watched soap operas and sometimes played bridge with friends. She never worked outside the home. Her husband and her children were her job. She was an attentive, patient parent who deeply cared for her children and tirelessly chauffeured them to their many activities throughout their years of adolescence. Vernon played all sports in high school, football and basketball because it was expected of him, baseball because he loved it. He was above average at all sports, not outstanding at anything. "Activities are important, particularly sports," Banker Winters often told him approvingly. "The academies look at much more than your grades." The only significant decision that Vernon had to make in the first 18 years of his life was which of the service academies he preferred. Mr. Winters, being cautious, was prepared politically to secure a nomination for Vernon to any of the academies. He strongly urged Vernon to think about applying to all three just in case. In his junior year at Columbus High School, Vernon took the Scholastic Aptitude Test, SAT, and made such a high score that it was obvious he would be able to pick his own favorite. He chose Annapolis and was not questioned about the reasons. If he had been, he would have answered that he just liked the idea of himself in a Navy uniform. Vernon's teenage years were remarkably linear, particularly considering that they occurred at a time of great social turmoil in the United States. The Winters family prayed together for hours after the Kennedy assassination, worried about local boys in the Vietnam War, remarked with concern when three prominent high school seniors refused to cut their hair and were expelled from school, and attended a couple of church-sponsored meetings on the evils of marijuana. But all these anxieties were outside the daily harmony of the Winters family. Music by the Beatles and the Rolling Stones did penetrate the controlled Winters culture, of course, and even some of the protest songs sung by Bob Dylan and Joan Baez were played on Vernon's stereo. But neither Vernon nor his sister Linda paid much serious attention to the lyrics. It was an easy existence. Vernon's closest friends were all from families like his. Mothers did not work. Fathers were bankers or lawyers or businessmen. Almost all were Republicans. But a patriotic Democrat was accepted and believed fervently in God, country, and the entire litany that ends in apple pie. Vernon was a good kid, even an exceptional kid, who first drew attention to himself by his performances in the annual church pageants at Christmas and Easter. The pastor of their church was a great believer that reenactment of the birth and crucifixion of Christ, performed by the children of the town, was a powerful way to reconfirm the faith of the local citizenry. And Reverend Pendleton was correct. The Columbus Presbyterian Church pageants were one of the highlights of the local year. When the church congregation and their friends saw their own children acting in the roles of Joseph, Mary, and even Christ, they became involved in the depicted events at an emotional level that was virtually impossible to achieve in any other way. Reverend Pendleton had two casts for each pageant so that more children could participate, but Vernon was always the star. When he was 11 years old, Vernon first portrayed Christ in the Easter pageant, and it was mentioned in the religious column of the Columbus newspaper that his tortured dragging of the cross had captured all of man's suffering. He was Joseph at Christmas and Jesus at Easter for 4 years running before he became too old and therefore no longer eligible for the pageant. The last 2 years, when Vernon was 13 and 14, the role of the Virgin Mary in the A-cast was played by the pastor's daughter, Betty. Vernon and Betty were together quite often while rehearsing, and both families were delighted. All four parents made no secret of the fact that they would generously approve if, assuming God wills it, the Vernon-Betty friendship would eventually mature into something more permanent. Vernon loved the attention he received from the pageant. Although Betty was touched deeply by the religious aspects of their performances, she remained truly devoted to God without wavering through everything in her life. Vernon's joy was standing by his proud parents after each performance and soaking up the praise. In high school, he gravitated naturally toward the small drama activity and was the lead in the school play every year. His mother supported this over his father's mild objections. "After all, dear," she would say, "I don't think anyone is really going to think Vernon's a sissy when he's playing three sports." And because she also vicariously enjoyed the applause. During the summer of 1968, just before he entered Annapolis, Vernon worked in his uncle's cornfields. Only a little more than 100 miles away, there were riots at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. But in Columbus, Vernon spent his summer evenings with Betty, talking with chums and drinking root beer at the A&W drive-in. Mr. and Mrs. Winters played miniature golf or canasta with Vernon and Betty from time to time. They were delighted and proud to have good, clean kids who were not hippies or drug victims. All in all, Vernon's last summer in Indiana was ordered, constrained, and very pleasant. As expected, he was a model student at Annapolis. He studied hard, obeyed all the rules, learned what his professors taught him, and dreamed of being the commander of an aircraft carrier or a nuclear submarine. He was not outgoing, for the big city boys seemed way too sophisticated for him, and he did not always feel comfortable when they talked about sex so casually. He was a virgin, and he was not ashamed of it. He just didn't feel the need to broadcast it around the U.S. Naval Academy. He had a couple of dates a month, nothing special, just when the occasion called for it. After a blind date early his junior year with Joanna Carr, a cheerleader at the University of Maryland, he took her out several more times. She was vivacious, lovely, fun, and modern. She drew out the best in Vernon, made him laugh and even relax. She was his date for the weekend of the Army-Navy game in Philadelphia. During his entire time at the academy, Vernon went home every summer and every Christmas to Indiana. He always saw Betty Pendleton when he was home. Betty graduated from high school and entered a nearby state college to study education. Once or twice a year, on special occasions, such as the anniversary of their first kiss or New Year's Eve, Betty and he would celebrate, in a sense, by doing a little something intimate, like controlled petting, outside only, or kissing lying down. Neither of them ever suggested any variation in this well-established routine. Vernon and Joanna were joined for the weekend by another midshipman, the closest acquaintance that Vernon had at Navy, who was still not quite what one would call a friend, Dwayne Eller, and his date from Columbia, an extremely loud and pushy girl named Edith. Vernon had never spent much time around a New York City girl, and he found Edith absolutely obnoxious. Edith was violently anti-Nixon and anti-Vietnam and seemed, despite the fact that her date for the weekend was going to be a military officer, anti-military as well. The original plan for the weekend had been decidedly proper, even backward given that it was 1970 and casual intercourse was not unusual on college campuses. Vernon and Dwayne were to share one motel room and the two girls were to share another. Over a pizza dinner the night before the game, Edith frequently insulted Joanna and Vernon both. "Miss Betty Crocker, go team go, and onward Christian soldiers, God's on our side." And Dwayne did nothing to intercede. Seeing that Edith was annoying Joanna, Vernon suggested to Joanna that it might be easier if the two of them shared a room instead of following the original game plan.
She readily agreed. Vernon had made no sexual moves on Joanna on the 4 or 5 dates they had had together. He had been attentive, had kissed her goodnight a couple of times, and had held her hand most of the evening on their last date. Everything had always been extremely proper, but there had never actually been any opportunity for intimacy. So Joanna really didn't know what to expect. She liked this handsome Hoosier midshipman, and had thought, a couple of times, about the possibility of the involvement developing into something serious. But Vernon was not yet anyone super special for her. Just after they made the room change, which a drunken Edith made more difficult by embarrassing them and herself with lewd comments, Vernon very carefully apologized to Joanna and told her that he would sleep in the car if she were offended. The room was a typical Holiday Inn room with 2 double beds. Joanna laughed.
"I know you didn't plan this," she said. "If I need protection, I can order you to your bed."
The first night, they enjoyed watching television and drinking more beer in the room. They both felt a little awkward. At bedtime, they shared a couple of almost passionate kisses, laughed together, and then went to separate beds. The next evening, after the post-game dance sponsored by the Naval Academy at a downtown Philadelphia hotel, Joanna and Vernon returned to their room at the Holiday Inn just before midnight. They had already changed into their jeans, and Vernon was brushing his teeth when there was a knock on their door. Joanna opened the door, and Dwayne Eller was standing there, a gigantic, shit-eating grin on his face and his hand clenched around some small object.
"This stuff is fucking fantastic," he said, thrusting a joint into Joanna's hand. "You've just got to try it."
Dwayne withdrew quickly with a wild smile. Joanna was a bright young woman, but it did not occur to her that her date had never even seen a joint, much less smoked one. She herself had smoked marijuana maybe a dozen times over a 4-year period, beginning in her junior year in high school. She liked it, if the situation and the company were right. She avoided it when she couldn't have control of her environment. But she had enjoyed the weekend with Vernon, and she thought this might be a perfect way to loosen him up a little. Under almost any circumstances, Vernon would have said no to any offer of marijuana, not just because he was against all drugs, but also because he would have been terrified that somehow he would be discovered and eventually thrown out of Annapolis. But here was his lovely date, a mainstream American cheerleader from Maryland, and she had just lit a joint and offered it to him. Joanna quickly saw that he was a grass neophyte. She showed him how to inhale and hold in the smoke, how not to bogart the joint, and eventually how to use a roach clip, one of her hairpins, to finish it off. Vernon had expected to feel as if he were drunk. He was astonished to find that he felt more alert. Much to his own surprise, he began reciting E.E. Cummings' poems he had been studying in lit. And then he and Joanna began to laugh. They laughed at everything. At Edith, football, the Naval Academy, their parents, even Vietnam. They laughed until they were almost crying. An overpowering hunger attacked Vernon and Joanna. They put on their jackets and walked out into the cold December air to find something to eat. Arm in arm, they paraded down the suburban parkway, finding a convenience store that was still open about a half mile from their motel. They bought Cokes and potato chips and Fritos and, much to Vernon's astonishment, a package of ding-dongs. Joanna opened the potato chips while they were still in the store. She put one in Vernon's mouth and they mmmed while the checkout clerk laughed with them. Vernon could not believe the taste of the chips. He ate the entire bag while they were walking back to their room. When he was finished, Vernon burst spontaneously into song, singing Maxwell's Silver Hammer by the Beatles. Joanna joined in vigorously on the bang-bang Maxwell's silver hammer came down upon his head. She reached up with the side of her fist and playfully banged on the top of his head. Vernon felt jaunty, liberated, as if he had known Joanna forever. He put his arm around her and kissed her ostentatiously as they turned into the driveway leading to their motel. They sat on the floor with all their munchies spread out in front of them. Vernon turned on the radio. It was tuned to a classical station in the middle of a symphony. Vernon was mesmerized by the sound. For the first time in his life, Vernon could actually hear the individual instruments of the orchestra in his head. He visualized the stage and saw the musicians pulling their bows across the violins.
He was fascinated and excited. Vernon told Joanna that all his senses were alive.
To Joanna Carr, it seemed that Vernon was finally opening up.
When he leaned over to kiss her, she was more than willing. They kissed sweetly but deeply several times while the symphony was playing. During a momentary break for some more munchies, Joanna tuned the radio to a rock and roll station. The music changed the pace in their necking. Driving, jangling sounds increased the tempo, and their kisses became more passionate. In his ardor, Vernon pushed Joanna down on the floor, and they kissed over and over again as they lay side by side, still fully clothed. They became enthralled by the strength of their arousal. The radio now started playing Light My Fire by the Doors, and Vernon Allen Winters of Columbus, Indiana, third-year midshipman at the U.S. Naval Academy, was no longer a virgin by the time the long song was over. The time to hesitate is through. No time to wallow in the mire. Try now, you can only lose, and our love become a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Vernon had never lost control of himself before in his entire life. But when Joanna stroked the outline of his swollen penis underneath his jeans, it was as if a giant wall of steel and concrete suddenly gave way. Years later, Vernon would still marvel at the raw passion he showed for 2, maybe 3 minutes. The combination of Joanna's insistent kisses, the grass, and the driving rhythms of the music pushed him over the edge. He was an animal. Still on the floor of the motel room, he pulled vigorously on Joanna's slacks several times, nearly tearing them as he managed to free them from her hips. Her underpants half followed the slacks. Vernon grabbed them roughly and pulled them down the rest of the way while he was squirming out of his own jeans. Joanna tried, in a quiet voice, to slow Vernon down, to suggest that maybe the bed would be better. Or at least it would be more pleasant if they actually took off their shoes and socks and didn't make love with their pants around their ankles, restricting their movement. But Vernon was gone. Years of restraint left him no ability to deal with his own surging desire. He was possessed. He crawled on top of Joanna, a look of frightening seriousness on his face. For the first time, she was scared, and her sudden fear heightened her sexual excitement. Vernon struggled for a few seconds. The music was now in the frenzied instrumental part of Light My Fire, to find the right spot, and then entered her abruptly and forcefully. Joanna felt him drive once, twice, and then shudder all over. He was done in maybe 10 seconds. She intuitively knew that it had been his first time, and the pleasure of that knowledge outweighed her bruised feelings about his lack of finesse and gentleness. Vernon said nothing and quickly fell asleep on the floor next to Joanna. She gamely went to the bed, pulled the bedspread off, cuddled into Vernon's arms on the floor, and wrapped the spread around them. She smiled to herself and drifted off to sleep, still a little puzzled by this Hoosier lying next to her. But she knew that they were now special to each other. How special, Joanna would never really know. When Vernon woke up in the middle of the night, he felt an overpowering sense of guilt. He could not believe that he had smoked dope and then virtually raped a girl he hardly knew. He had lost control. He had been unable to stop what he was doing and had clearly crossed the bounds of propriety. He winced when he thought about what his parents, or worse, Betty and Reverend Pendleton, would think about him if they could have seen what he had done. Then the guilt gave way to fear. Vernon imagined that Joanna was pregnant, that he had to leave Annapolis and marry her. What would he do? What kind of job would he have if he were not a naval officer? That he had to explain all this to his parents and to the Pendletons. Worse still, he next imagined that at any minute the motel would be raided and the police would find the butt of the joint in the roach clip. He would first be kicked out of the academy for drug abuse, then find out that he had made a girl pregnant. Vernon Winters was now really scared. Lying on the floor of a motel room on the outskirts of Philadelphia at 3 o'clock on a Sunday morning, he began to pray in earnest. Dear God, Vernon Winters prayed, asking for something specific for himself for the first time since he asked God to help him on the day that he took the SATs. Let me get out of this without harm, and I will become the most perfectly disciplined naval officer that you have ever seen. I will dedicate my life to defending this country that honors you. Just please help me. Eventually, Vernon managed to fall asleep again.
but his sleep was fitful and disturbed by vivid dreams. In one dream, Vernon was dressed in his midshipman's uniform, but was on stage back at the Columbus Presbyterian Church. It was the Easter pageant, and he was again Christ, dragging the cross to Calvary. The sharp edge of the cross on his shoulder was cutting through his uniform shirt, and Vernon was aware of anxiety that he might not pass inspection. He stumbled and fell. The cross cut deeper through the uniform, as he had feared, and he could see some blood running down his arm. "Crucify him!" Vernon heard someone shout in the dream. "Crucify him!" A group of people in the audience shouted together as Vernon tried vainly to see through the Klieg lights. He woke up sweating. For a couple of moments, he was disoriented. Then again, his emotions went the cycle from disgust to depression to fear as he played through the events of the night before. Joanna was tender and affectionate after she woke up, but Vernon was very distant. He explained his attitude by saying he was worried about his coming exams. A couple of times, Joanna started to talk about what had happened the night before, but each time he rapidly changed the subject. Vernon suffered through brunch and the drive back to College Park to Joanna's sorority house. Joanna tried to kiss him meaningfully when they parted, but Vernon did not reciprocate. He was in a hurry to forget the entire weekend. Back in the privacy of his own room in Annapolis, he contritely bargained again with God to let him escape unscathed. Midshipman Vernon Winters was true to his word. He not only never talked to Joanna Carr again — she called and failed to reach him a couple of times, sent two letters that were unanswered, and then gave up — he also gave up dating altogether during his final 18 months at Annapolis. He worked very hard on his studies and attended chapel, as he had promised God, twice each week. He graduated with honors and did his initial tour of duty on a large aircraft carrier. 2 years later, in June of 1974, after Betty Pendleton had completed college and obtained her teacher's certificate, Vernon married her in the Columbus Presbyterian Church, where they had played Joseph and Mary a dozen years earlier. They moved to Norfolk, Virginia, and Vernon believed that the pattern of his life was set. His life would be going out to sea for long stretches and then coming home for short stays with Betty and any children they might have. Vernon regularly thanked God for keeping up his part of the bargain, and he dedicated himself to being the finest officer in the U.S. Navy. All of his fitness reports praised his dependability and thoroughness. His commanding officers openly told him that he was admiral material. Until Libya. Or, more specifically, until he returned home after the Libyan action. For the entire world changed for Vernon Allen Winters during the few weeks after the American attack against Gaddafi. 7. Carol and Troy were sitting in deck chairs at the front of the Florida Queen. They were facing forward in the boat toward the ocean and the warm afternoon sun. Carol had removed her purple blouse to reveal the top of a one-piece blue bathing suit, but she was still wearing her white cotton slacks. Troy was shirtless in a white surfing outfit that came quite a way down his beautiful black legs. His body was lean and sinewy, clearly fit, but not overly muscled. They were talking casually and animatedly, laughing often in an easy way. Behind them, underneath the canopy, Nick Williams was reading A Fan's Notes by Fred Exley. Every now and then, he would look up at the other two for a few moments and then return to his book. "So why didn't you ever go to college?" Carol was asking Troy. "You clearly had the ability. You would have made a fantastic engineer." Troy stood up, took off his sunglasses, and walked to the railing. "My brother Jamie said the same thing," he said slowly, staring out at the quiet ocean. "But I was just too wild. When I finally did graduate from high school, I was hungry to know what the world was like. So I took off. I wandered all over the U.S. and Canada for a couple of years." "Was that when you learned about electronics?" Carol asked. She checked her watch to see what time it was.
"That was later, much later," said Troy, remembering. "Those 2 years of wandering, I didn't learn anything except how to survive on my wits, plus what it was like to be a black boy in a white man's world."
He looked at Carol. There was no noticeable reaction.
"I must have had 100 different jobs," he continued, looking back at the ocean. I was a cook, a copy boy, a bartender, a construction worker. I even taught swimming lessons in a private club. I was a bellman in a resort hotel, a greenskeeper for a country club. Troy laughed and turned again to see if Carol was paying attention. But I guess you're not interested in all this.
Sure I am, Carol said. It's fascinating to me. I'm trying to imagine what you looked like in a hotel uniform. And if Chief Nick is right, we still have another 10 minutes to pass until we reach where we're going. She dropped her voice. At least you talk. The professor is not exactly social.
Being a black bellhop at a southern Mississippi resort hotel was an amazing learning experience, Troy began, a smile spreading across his face. Troy loved to tell stories about his life. It always placed him center stage. Imagine, Angel, I'm 18 years old and I luck into a job at the grand old Gulfport Inn right on the beach, room and board plus tips. I'm on top of the world. At least until the chief bellman, an impossible little man named Fish, takes me out to the barracks where all the bellhops and kitchen staff live and introduces me to everybody as the new nigger bellhop. From bits of discussion, I can tell that the hotel is in some kind of trouble because of possible racial discrimination and hiring me as part of their response. My room in the barracks was right behind the 12th green on the golf course. A small bunk bed, a dresser built into the wall, a desk or table with a portable lamp, a sink to brush my teeth and wash my face. That's where I lived for 6 weeks. Down at the other end of the building was the great community bathroom that everyone left whenever I showed up. In my high school in Miami, virtually the entire student body was Cuban or black or both, so I knew almost nothing about white people. From books and television, I had this fantasy image of whites as handsome, competent, educated, and rich. Ha! My fantasy quickly vanished. You would not have believed the crew that worked in that hotel. The head bellman, Fish, smoked dope every night with his 16-year-old son, Danny, and dreamed of the day he would find $1 million left in somebody's room. His only other goal in life was to continue screwing the chef's wife, Marie, in the supply closet every morning until he died. One of the other bellmen was a poor, lonely soul whose real name was Saint John because his brilliant parents thought that Saint was a given name. He had only 6 teeth, wore thick glasses, and had a giant tumor underneath his left eye. St. John knew that he was ugly, and he worried all the time about losing his job because of his personal appearance. So Fish exploited him unmercifully by giving him all the shittiest assignments and forcing him to pay kickbacks with a portion of his tips. The other bellmen also ridiculed St. John at every opportunity and made him the butt of their practical jokes. One night I was sitting quietly in my room reading a book when there was a soft knock on the door. When I answered it, St. John was standing there. He looked confused and distracted. He was holding a small game box in one hand and a six-pack of beer in the other. I waited a few moments and then asked him what he wanted. He looked nervously in both directions and then asked me if I knew how to play chess. When I told him yes and added that I would enjoy a game, St. John grinned from ear to ear and mumbled something about being glad that he had taken a chance. I invited him in, and we played and talked and drank beer for almost 2 hours. He was one of 9 children from a poor rural Mississippi family. While we were playing, St. John casually let slip that he had been a little reluctant to ask me to play because Fish and Miller had told him that niggers were too dumb to play chess. St. John and I became friends, at least sort of, for the few more weeks that I stayed there. We were united by the deepest of bonds. We were both outsiders in that strange social structure created by the employees of the Gulfport Inn. It was from St. John that I learned about the many misconceptions that Southern whites have about blacks, Troy laughed. You know, one night St. John actually followed me to the bathroom to verify with his own eyes that I was not significantly larger than he was. Troy returned to his deck chair and looked at Carol. She was smiling. It was hard not to enjoy Troy's stories. He told them with such enthusiasm and self-involved charm. Under the canopy, Nick also had put his book aside and was listening to the conversation. Then there was this giant, feral, early 20s, who looked like Elvis Presley. He supplied liquor to the guests at cut rates, operated an escort service on call, and took excess hotel goods to sell at his sister's market. He rented part of my room to store some of the liquor. What a character. After big convention breakfasts, Farrell would pour the leftover orange juice in the pitchers into bottles and keep it for resale. One morning, the hotel manager found a case of the juice temporarily sitting in a room off the lobby and demanded to know what was going on. Farrell grabbed me and took me out front. He told me that he wanted to make a deal. If I would acknowledge that I had taken the juice, Farrell would pay me $20. He explained that if I confessed, nothing would happen to me, because niggers were expected to steal. But if he, Farrell, were caught, he would lose his job. Nick came out from under the canopy. "I hate to break this up," he said, a little sarcastic edge in his voice. "But according to our computer navigator, we are now at the south edge of the region on the map." He handed the map back to Carol. "Thanks, Professor," Troy laughed. "I believe you saved Carol from being talked to death." He walked over to where all the monitoring equipment had been set up on the footlocker next to the canopy. He turned on the power supply. "Hey, Angel, you want to tell me now how this all works?" Dale Michaels' ocean telescope was programmed to take three virtually simultaneous pictures at each fixed setting. The first of the pictures was a normal visible image. The second was the same field of view photographed at infrared wavelengths. And the third was a composite sonar image of the same frame. The sonar subsystem did not produce crisp pictures, only outlines of objects. However, it probed to greater depths than either the visible or infrared elements of the telescope and could be used even when the water underneath the boat was murky. Affixed to the bottom of almost any boat, the compact telescope could be driven 30 degrees back and forth, about the vertical, by a small internal motor. The observation schedule for the telescope was usually defined by a pre-programmed protocol. The details of this sequence, as well as the critical optical parameters for the telescope, were all stored in the system microprocessor. However, everything in the software could be changed in real time by manual input if the operator desired. Data from the telescope was carried to the rest of the electronic equipment on the boat by means of very thin fiber optics. These cables were bracketed along the edge of the boat. About 10% of the pictures reconstructed from this data were then displayed, after some very crude enhancements, on the boat's monitor in real time. But all the data taken by the telescope was automatically recorded in a 100 gigabit memory unit that adjoined the monitor. Another set of fiber optics connected the same memory unit with the boat's central navigation system and the servo motor actuators controlling the telescopes. These circuits were pulsed every 10 milliseconds so that the orientation of the telescope and the boat's location at the time of each telescope image could be stored together in the permanent file. Next to the monitor on top of the footlocker, but on the other side from the memory unit, was the system control panel. Dr. Dale Michaels and MOI were famous throughout the world for the cleverness of their inventions. However, these ingenious creations were not so easy to operate. Dale had tried to give Carol a crash course on the workings of the system the night before she had driven down to Key West from Miami. It had been almost useless. Eventually frustrated, Dale had simply programmed into the microprocessor an easy sequence that mosaicked the area under the boat in regular patterns. He then set the optical gains at normal default values and instructed Carol not to change anything. "All you have to do," Dr. Michaels had said as he had carefully loaded the system control panel into the station wagon, "is push this go button. Then cover the panel to make certain that nobody inadvertently hits the wrong command." So Carol certainly could not explain to Troy how anything worked. She walked over beside him on the boat, put her arm on his shoulder, and grinned sheepishly.
"I hate to disappoint you, my inquisitive friend, but I don't know any more about how this thing works than I told you when we were setting up all the equipment. To operate it, all we have to do is turn on the power supply, which you have already done, and then push this button." She pushed the go button on the panel. A picture of the clear ocean about 50 feet underneath the boat appeared immediately on the color monitor. The picture was amazingly sharp.
The threesome watched in wonder as a hammerhead shark swam through a school of small gray fish, swallowing hundreds of them in his awesome rush.
"As I understand it," Carol continued as both men stayed glued in fascination to the monitor, "the telescope system then does the rest, following a planned set of observations stored in its software. Obviously, we see what it sees here on this monitor. At least, we see the visual image. The simultaneous infrared and sonar pictures are stored on the recorder. My friend at MOI," she didn't want to alert them even more by using Dale's name, "tried to explain how I could change between the visual and infrared and sonar images, but it wasn't simple. You'd think it would be as easy as pushing an I for infrared or an S for sonar. Nope. You have to input as many as a dozen commands just to change which output signal is fed into the monitor." Troy was impressed, not just by the Ocean Telescope system, but also by the way Carol, a woman admittedly not educated in engineering or electronics, had clearly grasped the essentials of it.
"The infrared part of the telescope must measure thermal radiation," he said slowly, "if I remember my high school physics correctly. But how would underwater thermal variations tell you anything about whales?"
At this point, Nick Williams shook his head and turned away from the screen. He recognized that he was hopelessly out of his intellectual element with all these engineering terms, and he was more than a little embarrassed to admit his total ignorance in front of Carol and Troy. Nick also didn't believe for an instant that Carol had brought all this electronic wizardry on board to find whales that had strayed from their migration route. He walked over to the small refrigerator and pulled out another beer.
"And what we're going to do for the next 2 hours, if I understand it correctly, is ride around in the boat while you look for whales on that screen?"
Nick's derisive comment carried with it an unmistakable challenge. It intruded upon the warm and friendly rapport that had been created between Carol and Troy. She allowed herself to become irritated again by Nick's attitude and fired back her own verbal fusillade.
"That was the plan, Mr. Williams, as I told you when we left Key West. But Troy tells me that you're something of a treasure hunter, or at least were some years ago, and since you seem to have convinced yourself that treasure is really what I'm after, perhaps you'd like to sit here next to me and look at the same pictures to make sure I don't miss any whales, or treasure as the case may be."
Nick and Carol glared at each other for a few moments. Then Troy stepped between them.
"Look, Professor, and you too, Angel. I don't pretend to understand why you two insist on pissing each other off. But it's a pain in the ass for me. Can't you just cool it for a while? After all," Troy added, looking first at Nick and then at Carol, "if you two go for a dive, you're partners. Your lives may depend on one another. So knock it off."
Carol shrugged her shoulders and nodded.
"Okay by me," she said. But seeing no immediate response from Nick, she couldn't resist another shot. "Provided that Mr. Williams recognizes his responsibility as a PADI member and stays sober enough to dive."
Nick's eyes flashed angrily. Then he walked over to the deck railing and dramatically poured his new beer into the ocean.
"Don't worry about me, sweetheart," he said, forcing a smile. "I can take care of myself. You just worry about what you do."
The Ocean Telescope microprocessor contained a special alarm subroutine that sounded a noise like a telephone ring whenever the programmed alarm conditions were triggered. At Carol's request, Dale Michaels had personally adapted the normal alarming algorithm just before she left for Key West so that it would react to either a large creature moving across the field of view or a stationary unknown object of significant size. After he had finished the logic design for the small change and sent it to his software department for top priority coding and testing, Dale had smiled to himself. He was amused by his complicity with Carol. This piece of technological subterfuge would certainly convince Carol's companions, whoever they might be, that she was earnest in her search for whales. At the same time, the alarm would also sound if what Carol was really seeking, supposedly an errant and secret Navy missile currently under development, appeared on the ocean floor underneath the boat. The basic structure for both alarm algorithms was easy to understand.
To identify a moving animal, it was sufficient to overlay two or three images taken less than a second apart at any wavelength, although there was greater accuracy in the process with the sharper visual images, and then compare the data using the knowledge that most of the scene should be unchanged. Significant miscompares, connected areas in the overlay that differed from image to image, would suggest the presence of a large moving creature. To identify foreign objects in the field of view, the alarm algorithm took advantage of the tremendous storage capacity of the memory unit in the telescope data processing system. The near simultaneous infrared and visual images were fed into the memory unit and then crudely analyzed against a data set that contained chains of pattern recognition parameters over both wavelength regions. These pattern parameters had been developed through years of careful research and had been recently expanded by MOI to include virtually everything normal, plants, animals, reef structures, etc., that might be seen on the ocean floor around the Florida Keys. Any large object that didn't correlate in real time with this existing database would be flagged and the alarm would sound. The alarms made it unnecessary to sit patiently in front of the screen and study the thousands of frames of data as they were received on the boat. Even Troy, a confessed knowledge junkie whose interest in everything was almost insatiable, grew tired of staring at the monitor after about 10 minutes, particularly when the boat entered into deeper water and very little could be seen in the visual images. A couple of solitary sharks triggered alarms and created momentary excitement about 20 minutes after the telescope was activated, but a long period void of any discoveries followed. As the afternoon waned, Nick became more and more impatient. "I don't know why I allowed myself to be talked into this wild goose chase," he grumbled to nobody in particular. "We could have been preparing the boat for the weekend charter." Carol ignored Nick's comment and studied the map one more time. They had traversed from south to north the region she and Dale had defined and were now moving slowly east along the northern periphery. Dale had constructed the search area based upon his own inferences from the questions asked him by the Navy. He probably could have pinned down the area of interest with greater certainty with a few more questions of his own, but he hadn't wanted to arouse any suspicions. Carol knew that the search was a little like finding a needle in a haystack, but she had thought it would be worthwhile because of the potential payoff. If she could somehow find and photograph a secret Navy missile that had crashed near a populated area, what a scoop that would be. But now she too was growing a little impatient, and it was hard for her to revive her earlier excitement after the long afternoon in the sun. They would have to head back to Key West soon to ensure arrival by nightfall. "Oh, well," she thought to herself with resignation, "at least I gave it a shot. And as my father used to say, nothing ventured, nothing gained." She was standing all the way at the prow of the boat when suddenly alarms started coming from the memory unit next to the monitor. One ring, then two, followed by a brief silence. A third ring then sounded and was rapidly joined by a fourth. Carol rushed excitedly toward the monitor. "Stop the boat!" she shouted imperiously at Nick. But she was too late. By the time she reached the monitor, the alarms had stopped, and she could not see anything on the screen. "Turn around! Turn around!" a frustrated Carol hollered immediately, not noticing that Nick was again glaring at her. "Aye, aye, Capitan," Nick said, jerking on the wheel with such force that Carol lost her balance. The monitor and other electronic equipment started to slide off their flimsy mountings on the top of the footlocker. They were rescued at the last minute by Troy. The Florida Queen veered sharply in the water. Despite the quietness of the ocean, a small wave came over the railing on the low side of the deck, catching Carol from the knees down. The bottom of her cotton slacks were left clinging to her calves. Her white tennis shoes and socks were drenched. Nick made no effort to hide his amusement. Carol was about to joust with him again when the renewed ringing of the alarms diverted her attention. Regaining her squishy footing as the boat leveled off, she saw in the monitor that they were above a coral reef, and deep beneath the boat, barely discernible on the screen, were three whales of the same kind that she had seen on the beach that morning at Deer Key. They were swimming together in what appeared to be an aimless pattern. But there was more. The special alarm message code indicated that there was also a foreign object in or near to the same field of view as the desultory whales.
Carol could not contain her excitement. She clapped her hands. "Anchor, please," she shouted, and then she laughed. She saw that Troy had already thrown the anchor overboard. A few minutes later, Carol was hurriedly putting on her buoyancy vest in the aft portion of the boat behind the canopy. Her mask and her flippers had already been adjusted and were beside her on the deck. Troy was helping her by holding up the air bottle that was built into the back of the bulky vest. "Don't worry about Nick," Troy said. "He may be grumpy today for some reason, maybe because Harvard lost the basketball game, but he's a fabulous diver, and he has the reputation of being the best dive teacher in the Keys." He grinned. "After all, he taught me a couple of months ago, and we're not even supposed to be able to swim." Carol smiled and shook her head at Troy. "Don't you ever stop joking," she said. She slid her free arm through the second opening, and the vest fell into place. "By the way," she continued softly, "for an expert diver, your friend certainly uses antiquated equipment." At this moment, she regretted her decision to leave her customized diving vest in the station wagon. She always used it when she dove with Dale, and it had all the latest advances, such as ABC, automatic buoyancy compensation, and a perfect pocket for her underwater camera. But after all the brouhaha when she came through the marina headquarters with her footlocker of electronic equipment, Carol had decided not to attract further attention by bringing in a state-of-the-art diving vest. "Nick thinks the new vests make it too easy for the diver. He wants them to have to adjust their buoyancy manually, so that they are more conscious of how far down they are." Troy looked Carol over. "You're pretty light. This belt may be enough by itself. Do you normally use any weights?" Carol shook her head and pulled the belt around her waist. Nick came around the canopy, carrying his mask and flippers. He had already put on his diving vest with air bottle and his weighted belt. "Those whales of yours are still in the same spot down there," he said. "I've never seen whales hang around like that." He handed her a piece of chewing tobacco. She rubbed the tobacco on the inside of her mask to prevent fogging, while Nick walked around behind her. He looked at her air gauge and checked both her regulator and the secondary mouthpiece that he might have to use to share her air in the event of an emergency. Nick talked to Carol while he was making her final equipment checks. "This is your charter," he began in what sounded like a friendly tone, "so we can go almost anywhere you want while we are down there. The dive will not be too difficult, since it's only 45 feet or so to the floor. However," Nick moved around in front of Carol and looked directly in her eyes, "I want one thing thoroughly understood. This is my boat, and I am responsible for the safety of the people on it, including you, whether you like it or not. Before we dive, I want to make certain that you will follow my lead under the water." Carol recognized that Nick was trying to be diplomatic. It even flashed through her mind that he looked sort of cute standing there in front of her in his diving gear. She decided to be gracious. "Agreed," she said. "But one thing before we descend. Remember that I'm a reporter. I will have a camera with me and may want you to move from time to time. So don't get angry if I motion you out of the way." Nick smiled. "Okay," he said. "I'll try to remember." Carol put on her flippers and mask. Then she picked up her underwater camera by the strap and threw it over her neck and shoulder. Troy helped her tighten the strap in the back. Nick was sitting on the side of the boat at a break in the railing, right next to a crude ladder that Troy had just dropped overboard. "I've checked the water already," Nick said, "and there's quite a current up here. Let's go down the anchor rope until we reach the ocean floor. Then you can pick the direction from there." Nick rolled backward off the boat. In a moment, he surfaced, treading water. Carol returned his thumbs-up sign, the signal between divers that everything's all right, and sat down herself on the side of the boat. Troy helped her make one last comfort adjustment to her vest. "Good luck, Angel," Troy said. "I hope you find what you're looking for. And be careful." Carol put the regulator in her mouth, took a breath, and then repeated Nick's backward roll maneuver. The ocean water felt cool against her sun-baked back. In a few seconds, she joined Nick over at the anchor rope, and the two of them repeated the thumbs-up sign. Nick led the way down. He went hand over hand, cautiously, never completely releasing the rope. Carol followed carefully. She could feel the strong current that Nick had mentioned. It pulled at her, trying to take her away from the rope, but she managed to hold on. Every 6 to 8 feet in the descent, Nick stopped to equalize the pressure in his ears and looked up to see both that Carol was following and that she was all right. Then he continued his descent. There was nothing much to see until they reached the reef beneath them. The telescope pictures had been so sharp that they had been misleading. The reef, with its riot of color and its surfeit of plant and animal life, had seemed to be right underneath them because of the automatic focusing action of the optical system. But 35 feet is a long way down. Any normal three-story building could have been sitting on the ocean floor underneath the Florida Queen, and it would not have touched her hull. When they finally reached the top of the reef where the anchor was implanted, Carol realized she had made a mistake. She did not recognize her surroundings and therefore did not know which direction to take to find the whales. She reproached herself briefly for not having spent a few more moments studying the monitor to make sure that she knew where all the landmarks were. Oh, well, Carol then thought. It's too late for that now. I'll just pick a direction and go. Besides, I don't have any idea where the alarm object is anyway. Visibility in the water was fair to good, maybe 50 to 60 feet in all directions. Carol adjusted her buoyancy slightly and then pointed to a gap between two reef structures, both of which were covered with kelp, sea anemones, and the ubiquitous coral. Nick nodded his head. Tucking her arms to her side to streamline her movement, Carol kicked up and down with her flippers and swam toward the gap. Behind her, Nick watched Carol swim with appreciation and admiration. She moved through the water as gracefully as the school of yellow and black angelfish beside her. Nick had not interrogated Carol very much about her diving experience and had not known exactly what to expect. He had suspected from her ease and familiarity with the equipment that she was a seasoned diver, but he had not prepared himself for an underwater pier. Except for Greta, Nick had not encountered a woman before who was as comfortable under the water as he was. Nick absolutely loved the peace and serenity of the rich and vibrant world beneath the ocean surface. The only sound he ever heard down there was his own breathing. All around him, the coral reefs teemed with life of unimaginable beauty and complexity. There, underneath him now, was a grouper taking a bath by sitting at the bottom of a natural hole and letting dozens of tiny cleaner fish eat away all the accumulated parasites. A moment earlier, Nick's downward excursion toward the ocean floor had scared up a manta ray hidden in the sand. This large ray, called a devilfish by the Kanyashenti, had undulated out of its hiding place at the last moment and just missed Nick with its powerful and dangerous tail. Nick Williams felt at home down in this watery world at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. It was his recreation and his refuge. Whenever he was distressed or disturbed by events on the surface, he knew that he could dive and find relaxation and escape. Except on this particular dive, he was aware of an ineffable emotion, a beginning perhaps, a longing that was barely defined, possibly mixed up with a memory of years ago. He was following a beautiful mermaid as she swam along the reef, and the sight stirred him. I have acted like a schoolboy, he thought, and a bore, or worse. And why? Because she is pretty? No, because she is so alive, so much more alive than I am. Carol and Nick made two different excursions, each time starting from the anchor rope, without finding the whales or anything else unusual. When they returned to the anchor after the second unsuccessful foray, Nick pointed at his watch. They had been under the water for almost half an hour already. Carol wagged her head up and down and then held up her index finger, indicating that she would try one more direction. They found the whales right after they crossed over a big upward bulge in the reef that came within 15 feet of the surface. Nick saw them first and pointed down. The three whales were about 20 feet below them and maybe 30 yards ahead. They were still swimming slowly, more or less together, in the same directionless, near-circular pattern that Nick and Carol had watched on the screen. Carol waved Nick out of the way and pointed at her camera. She then swam toward the whales, taking pictures as she approached them while carefully monitoring her depth and equalizing the pressure in her ears. Nick swam down beside her. He was certain the whales had seen the two of them, but for some reason, they had made no attempt to flee. In all his years as a diver, Nick had only once seen a whale in the open ocean except the nearby presence of a human.
And that had been a calving mother in a Pacific Ocean lagoon off of Baja, California, whose birth pangs were a more powerful force than her instinctive fear of humans. Here, even when Carol approached to within 20 feet or so, the whales continued their indolent drift. They appeared to be lost, or maybe even drugged. Carol slowed her approach when the whales made no attempt to get away. She took some more photographs. Close-up pictures of whales in their natural habitat were still uncommon, so her trip had already been a journalistic success. But she, too, was puzzled by their behavior. Why were they ignoring her presence? And what were they doing hanging around this particular spot? She remembered being surprised by the solitary whale during her morning swim and wondered again if somehow all these strange events were related. Nick was off to her right, about 20 yards away. He was pointing at something on the other side of the whales and gesturing for Carol to come toward him. She swam away from the great mammals and headed in Nick's direction. She saw immediately what had attracted his attention. Below the whales, just above the ocean floor, there was a large dark hole in the bottom of an imposing reef structure. At first glance, it appeared to be the entrance to an underground cave of some kind. But Carol's sharp eyes noticed that the lip-shaped fissure was extremely smooth and symmetric, almost suggesting to her that it was an engineering construction of some kind. She laughed at herself as she swam up beside Nick. The amazing underwater world and the bizarre behavior of these whales were playing tricks with her mind. Nick pointed down at the hole and then at himself, indicating that he was going down to check it out more closely. When he started to leave, Carol had a sudden impulse to reach for his foot and pull him back. A moment later, as she watched Nick swim away, a powerful fear of unknown origin swept over her. She began to tremble as she struggled gamely with this strange emotion. Goosebumps appeared on her arms and legs, and Carol felt an overwhelming desire to get away, to escape, before something terrible happened. An instant later, she saw one of the whales move toward Nick. If Carol had been on land, she could have yelled, but 50 feet deep in the ocean, there was no way to warn someone from afar. As Nick drew near the opening, unaware of any danger, he was brushed to the side by one of the whales with such force that he bounced against the reef and then caromed off. He fell down onto a small spot of sand on the ocean floor. Carol swam toward him quickly, while keeping a careful eye on the whales. Nick had lost his regulator and did not seem to be making any attempt to replace it. She drew up beside him and flashed the thumbs-up sign. There was no response. Nick's eyes were closed. Carol felt a surge of adrenaline as she reached for Nick's regulator and thrust it into his mouth. She beat against his mask with her fist. After a few painfully long seconds, Nick opened his eyes. Carol tried thumbs-up again. Nick shook his head, as if he were clearing out the cobwebs, smiled, and then returned the okay signal. He started to move, but Carol restrained him. She indicated with gestures for him to sit still while she hurriedly looked him over. From the force with which Nick had hit the reef, Carol feared the worst. Even if his diving gear was all right, certainly his skin would have been ripped and torn by the sharp coral and the impact. But incredibly, there did not appear to be significant damage to either Nick or the equipment. All she could find were a couple of small scrapes. The three whales remained in the same area where they had been before. Looking up at them from below, Carol thought that they looked like sentinels guarding a particular piece of ocean territory. Back and forth they swam, inscribing a total composite arc of maybe 200 yards. Whatever it had been that had caused one of the whales to vary its swimming pattern and run into Nick was certainly unclear, but Carol did not want to risk another encounter. She motioned for Nick to follow her, and they swam about 30 yards away to a sandy trench between the reefs. Carol planned to return to the surface as soon as it was clear that Nick was not seriously hurt. But while Carol was thoroughly surveying his body to make certain that she had not overlooked any serious lacerations in her hurried check, Nick discovered two parallel indentations in the sand below him. He grabbed Carol's arm to show her what he had found. The indentations were grooved like tank tracks and were about 3 inches deep. They appeared to be fresh. In one direction, the tracks ran toward the reef fissure underneath the three whales. In the other direction, the parallel lines extended as far as Nick and Carol could see, running along the sandy trench between the two major reefs in the area. Nick pointed up the trench and then swam away in that direction, following the tracks with fascination. He did not turn around to see if Carol were following.
Carol quickly backtracked as close to the fissure as she dared. Was she imagining again, or were the three whales watching her as she crept along the ocean floor? To take some pictures and to verify that the tracks did indeed emanate from the opening in the reef. She thought she saw a network of similar indentations converging just in front of the fissure. But she did not tarry long. She didn't want to be separated from Nick in this spooky place. When she turned around, he was just barely in sight. But he had fortunately stopped when he realized that Carol was not behind him. Nick made an apologetic gesture when she finally caught up with him. At one point, the parallel lines disappeared as the sandy trench turned to rock, but Nick and Carol located the continuation of the same tracks some 50 yards farther along. The trench eventually became so narrow that they were forced to swim 6 feet or so above it to keep from banging against the rocks and coral on either side. Soon thereafter, the tracks and the trench made a left turn and disappeared under an overhang. Carol and Nick stopped and floated in the water facing each other. They carried on a conversation with hand gestures. At length, they decided that Carol would go down first to see if anything was under the overhang, since she wanted a close-up photograph of the disappearance of the tracks anyway.